Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. The numbers of infection and death from COVID-19 can be hard for our brains to process. Millions infected, hundreds of thousands dead. If you live in a tribal nation, it's likely not as difficult to comprehend the scale of the pandemic because there's a good chance you've lost friends, family, or both to the virus. Even though many tribal nations were quicker than most states and the U.S. federal government to take action to protect citizens, CDC statistics show infection and death from COVID-19 is higher among American Indians, Alaska Natives than among non-Hispanic whites. And based on data from 14 participating states, age-adjusted COVID-19-associated mortality among Native people was 1.8 times that among non-Hispanic whites. Today, we talk about the social, emotional, and economic toll of the pandemic on Indigenous people. What are some of the reasons Native people are disproportionately impacted, and how are tribal communities responding? Joining us this hour is Jennifer Weston. She's a Lakota citizen of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and director of the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project. Welcome back, Jennifer. Good to have you back with us.
Good morning, Mindy. Thank you.
Also with us, Nelson Andrews Jr. He's Department of Director of Emergency Management for the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe. Welcome, Nelson.
Thank you.
And Brian Whedon, he's with us. He's a Mashpee Wampanoag Tribal Councilman. Brian, good to have you as well.
Hi, Winikisuk. Good day.
We know American and Alaska Native people are among the highest risk groups for contracting and dying from COVID-19. Jennifer, unfortunately, Native people have repeatedly suffered disproportionately from disease since white Europeans arrived here. Can you put this current pandemic into historical perspective for us?
Sure. I think that's a conversation a lot of folks have been having in their households. And I think the most resonant and immediate pandemic that comes to mind is the flu pandemic of the early 20th century. And one example that I've been talking a lot about with friends and family is the rise of the jingle dress as a healing movement by women to bring that kind of spiritual energy and prayer to our communities and families. And that originated among the Ojibwe people, which is a sister language of the Wampanoag. But certainly Nelson and Brian can both speak to, you know, the long, long history of pandemics that, you know, have impacted communities here so much more deeply over many more centuries as a first contact nation.
Hmm. Nelson or Brian, do you want to add anything to what Jennifer's saying?
I'll just jump in real quick if that's fine. So as Jennifer's relating to, back in 1616, traders from Europe, they brought disease to the Wampanoag territory. That included the geographic area of all 69 tribes of the Wampanoag Nation, from present-day Provincetown to Narragansett Bay, actually. There was an estimated 45,000 of our ancestors, Wampanoag Nation members, had died from that initial pandemic. And today we're in the midst of this new pandemic, right? So, the difference today is we are, we're collaborating with our federal and state partners to get through this. But as you had mentioned earlier, it's definitely not, we don't get the same support and resources that the states are allotted. And we can get into that a little bit more if you'd like after.
Yeah. Nelson, what are some of the reasons Native people are more susceptible to contracting and dying from the coronavirus?
Pre-existing conditions, mainly hereditary, based off, within our genes. Another issue is the lack of resources. So Native American tribes, we have, normally, if you're lucky, you'll have an Indian Health Service clinic, right? But the state of the Indian Health Service clinic isn't going to be up to par, say, with, a private funded hospital, with large, robust staff capabilities, resources, in space. Tribes are, some tribes say out in the Midwest or even where Jennifer is from, they have to travel many miles just to get to their clinic, right? So think about, all the things they're suffering through at home at the time, right? You have winter chills, the flu, things like that as well. And now you got to walk or try to find transportation to a clinic that may or may not have the resources or capabilities to even help you during this time.
Can Brian, I just add to that, Mindy, as well?
Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to highlight as well the multi-generational families and households that many of our communities live in, you know, very deliberately because we really treasure our elders and our children, and we want them to, you know, thrive together in the same spaces. And, you know, I am thinking of one family in my hometown where 14 family members live in, you know, a three-bedroom home. And that's not seen as, you know, maybe just a hardship. You know, that's also a way of a family being close together and taking care of one another and supporting one another. But just think about the impossibilities of isolating when one or three or eight of those family members become infected with COVID and have all different kinds of symptoms at different times, and some are asymptomatic. And so those are other challenges that our communities are facing, I think, everywhere in Indian country. And just to go back to what Nelson said about pre-existing conditions and, you know, some of the genetic predispositions, those are really inherited because of intergenerational trauma and because of the incredibly violent changes that our families have experienced in loss of our food systems and control over our ecosystems and the impacts that that has had on our ability to feed ourselves from the land, from the water. You know, there are still families everywhere in Mashpee and the tribal community who hunt and fish by the season. And think about the state of the Cape waterways right now. You know, that is a food source that can't really be replaced by going to Stop and Shop. It just can't. Mm. And that is something that we really have to think about when we're talking about pre-existing conditions, because that impact is something that's not easily undone, but it's something that many, many communities across Indian country are working on in terms of the food sovereignty movement and restoration of control and collaboration, models that really value and lift up Indigenous and Native American voices in terms of restoring those systems to health, because our ancestors have lived here for many, many thousands of years.
Yeah. Brian, has the Mashpee tribe been able to gather statistics on the number of citizens who've contracted coronavirus or died from COVID-19?
We've actually been working through our Indian Health Services. The problem that the tribe faces is that majority of our tribal citizens that live outside of our geographical area don't utilize Indian Health Services, and that's how we're doing a lot of our contact tracing to determine, you know, the members that have, you know, contracted it on a, you know, locally around here in our community, in our CHISDA that we do service. So it's hard to give a definite, you know, answer on how many of our tribal members, because we're around almost 3,000 tribal members that live in various states, you know, and communities, you know, throughout the nation. So Nelson does give out, you know, reports on the daily to the tribal community through social media, Facebook, emails, just daily COVID updates. And that's been really helpful. And so far, to my knowledge, I'm not aware of any deaths that we've had locally in the community from it. So unless Nelson...
Yeah, so Nelson, do you is that your knowledge as well?
Yeah, so I just wanted to jump back to what Brian was alluding to. He makes a very great point. One of the major issues that we've been facing throughout this whole pandemic since we declared state of emergency back in March is the data, right? The state of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth, they report on how many folks, you know, from different ethnic groups may have, you know, contracted the virus, right? So they list it as Native American. There is no section or data portal that says what tribe they may have, they've been part of, right? So we have two federally recognized tribes here in the state of Massachusetts. One thing we were working on with the CDC when we had them deployed here at Emergency Operations Center was to get a script over to the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. So they were able to, so they would ask if anybody that was calling or anybody who they were contact tracing with was from a specific tribe. That has not been the case, and we're working with FEMA and also with our new public health advisor to potentially get to the get to that point, but back to the deaths, you know, that ties in with folks that may have died, like say somewhere else within the region or within the country, we may not have knowledge of, but there is no report of that through our Indian Health Service clinic. We've had 65 positive cases as a result at our Indian Health Service clinic, with close to 1,900 folks tested.
Oh. Jennifer, the region of the Standing Rock Reservation is vast and remote. Can you take a few minutes to describe that region and give us a better sense of the tribal community there?
Sure. So Standing Rock is over 3,600 square miles. Our traditional territory is much larger, a treaty territory that we've retained through documents negotiated on a government-to-government basis with the United States. But today's reservation land base it spans the border of North and South Dakota. It's tremendously rural. There's only around 8,600 citizens who live there, but one in five of those citizens are non-tribal members, so they consider themselves citizens of the state of South Dakota or the state of North Dakota. And, it's a tremendously rural area. I think the population density is something like 0.4 persons per square mile. There are eight tribal communities or districts on Standing Rock, and each district has a local council, so an elected governing body, sort of like the equivalent of like a city council that then reports up to our tribal council. Our tribal council consists of 17 elected officials. We have a tribal chair, vice chair, secretary, and then 14 elected tribal council members. Eight of those represent the districts where they reside. They're elected from the district. And then there are six at-large representatives. And it's important to make the point that, among the perhaps 6,500 to 8,000 tribal citizens who live on Standing Rock or in the border towns around there, like Bismarck or Mobridge. We also abut the Cheyenne River Reservation, which is a sister tribe of our relatives. So there are many people who, live in communities on Cheyenne River and come back and forth to Standing Rock all the time. But the difference in, local communities is really, striking, just in terms of things like health disparities, voting trends, for example. You can see the blue votes in the outline of the reservations. So there's definitely, a big divide in the communities on Standing Rock, even though many of our families are intermarried, we're neighbors, we shop at the same grocery stores. And I should also say that there are probably well over 16,000, probably close to 17,000 tribal citizens of our nation. And many are like me, and we don't live within the exterior boundaries of Standing Rock. So I do not vote in elections. We don't allow voting for people who don't physically reside within the exterior boundaries. So even someone who lives, 5 miles across the border is not able to vote because they're not residing in their home district.
Jennifer, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe was ahead of the state of South Dakota in calling for mask wearing, social distancing, and quarantining of infected individuals. Can you tell us more about the initial steps the tribe took to slow the spread? Because I think many listeners will be surprised at how stringent regulations and enforcement were.
Yeah, and not just on Standing Rock. I mean, I really want to credit our sister nations throughout South Dakota. Cheyenne River, for example, actually took the extremely proactive step of setting up physical checkpoints, so barriers on every state highway entering the reservation. That was hugely controversial with the governor's office, who obviously did not want to have any kind of masking or, really public health messaging around the virus at all. On Standing Rock, there was just a tremendous amount of organizing, setting up an incident command structure. We have a workforce of over 400 tribal employees. And similarly to here in Mashpee, most of those folks were sent home from the physical office buildings in mid-March and had to figure out how to work from home. And, they were able to do that through the support of our IT department and, all of the incredibly talented people within our tribal workforce. Mask mandates were I think a little bit late in coming, actually, but it was something that was talked about and promoted in terms of social distancing and the need to, you know, practice precautions because of the nature of our multi-generational households. And we're fortunate to have a radio station on Standing Rock that KLND that serves both Standing Rock and Cheyenne River to some extent, although again, it's a very rural area. So it sort of depends on where you live in terms of accessing, internet and radio signals, and there are communities where there's no cable access, for example, so there's only satellite or, antenna frequencies that are available. But I think people did really, they did the best they could given, just to harken back to what Nelson said about the Indian Health Services structure just not being as well resourced as mainstream hospitals and private clinics. And on Standing Rock, we do have an Indian Health Service hospital that's in, our capital of our nation in Fort Yates, North Dakota. That's a really long drive from the southern communities. In my hometown, which is McLaughlin, South Dakota, or the Bear Soldier District on Standing Rock, we're fortunate to have an Indian Health Services clinic, a dental clinic. They're probably comparable in size to the facilities that you see on the Mashpee Wampanoag Reservation. So they're very small. But, they do the best they can with the resources they have, but they're perpetually underfunded, and it's essentially a system of, rationed health care for people, and it was not providing an adequate standard of care or access to care pre-pandemic, and obviously the challenges that have arisen since then have just been tremendously heartbreaking at many levels, and, that's not to critique the people who are working so hard within those systems at all, because they are truly doing their best, and we all see that and we know that.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the social, emotional, and economic toll of the pandemic on Indigenous people. With us is Jennifer Weston. She is a Lakota citizen of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and director of the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project. Nelson Andrews, Jr., he's Department Director of Emergency Management for the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe. And Brian Whedon, he's a Mashpee Wampanoag Tribal Councilman. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Nelson, under your direction, the Mashpee tribe also took action early on, declaring a state of emergency even before the U.S. federal government did. What were the red flags that you saw that so many others were either missing or ignoring?
Sure. So during the onset of the pandemic, we were noticing the case numbers rising within the state and also within the county. We do have an MOU with Barnstable County. So we were already collaborating with the pandemic, the numbers that were rising, et cetera. And part of my background in training is I was with FEMA. I was a FEMA employee for 12 years. So I was, already in the midst of writing plans for pandemics prior to this. So all the red, some of the red flags were the rising case numbers. But before, like, as you mentioned, before, it became a national pandemic, before the president declared the national pandemic, we were mapping out the plan. I had approached the tribal council and requested for them to declare a state of emergency. So basically, from there, what we did was we had to shut down our government center and internally, right? So to limit the staff folks that would potentially contract the virus. And then we went straight into resources. We went ahead and gathered all the masks and any sanitizer that we had, and we started distributing it to our most vulnerable folks. But during that time as well, what we were able to do was request direct federal assistance through FEMA. And in doing that, we were the first tribe in the region and the second tribe in the entire country to become a direct recipient under the Federal Emergency Management Agency for the National COVID-19 Emergency Declaration. But after doing that, we realized not too many tribes had the plans in place that were needed. One of them was called the Public Administrative Plan. That plan is basically the key plan to go ahead in requesting an emergency declaration, right? So FEMA did not have one. They didn't have a tribal public assistance plan. We wrote that plan, and then they used our plan to assist the four other tribes in our region that became direct recipient tribes. The remaining tribes didn't go that route. It was easier for them to go under the state. FEMA had asked us if we wanted to go under the state because it was easier. I said, this is about our sovereignty. So because we did decide to go directly under FEMA as direct recipients, we were able to get resources immediately. And after the initial point of declaration, and we were able to get some of these resources, and we were able to provide the IHS clinic with 2,000 test kits that they're still using today to test our tribal citizens and all the PPE they're using, in addition to many pallets of masks and gloves and sanitizer that were distributed at our point of distribution site. This is an ongoing process. We're at day number 327, our emergency operations center being activated. And by doing so, we have led the way, and FEMA has chosen our tribe as the example during the COVID response. A lot of time and efforts and resources were involved, including applying for many grants, federal grants as well, to help us get through this. So,
Yeah. Brian, many Native people distrust the U.S. government. Remind us of the roots of this distrust.
Well, the roots of this distrust, has been going on here, for multiple generations and centuries here, from the first point of contact. There was a treaty between the English and the Pilgrims and the Wampanoags, that basically we would be, to their aid if they were under attack, and, vice versa, for us if we were under attack. And, they didn't really uphold their end of the treaties. And after Massasoit had died, the sachem, the great leader at the time, Usamequin, you see his next son step into leadership, Wamsutta, and his English name was Alexander. And he didn't last long, and you don't really hear much about him before you hear about his younger brother, King Philip. And that's because he had, passed away and had died at a very young age, which was not, common for Wampanoag people back then because of the traditional foods and living off the land. Wampanoag people would live well into, their 90s, 100s, if not. And, he had gone and visited an English village, and on his way back, he had, passed away. So his young brother thought that, he might have been poisoned or something might have happened to him. And that's kind of what sparked, King Philip's War. Also after that, you think of, the Great Pequot Massacre, the Great Swamp Massacre with the Narragansett Nation, that border us in Rhode Island. So there were a lot of massacres and things that were going on around the time, right after, quote-unquote first contact here, with the English. And it hasn't been, right ever since. Specifically here in Mashpee, we were an Indian district in a plantation. We, had some of our ancestors go all the way over to England to ask the King James of England at the time for our own self-governance because we were tired of these overseers that were coming on the plantation or wouldn't come on the plantation to come check on, the natives that were living there at the time. And we got our own self-independence only for the Commonwealth, to overturn that and to incorporate us against our will in 1870. On the Cape, you see a lot of towns, that were incorporated in the 1600s. And there's two towns in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that were incorporated in 1870. And that happens to be what used to be called Gayhead, which is now Aquinnah. And the Aquinnah Wampanoags obviously live there, our sister nation of our Martha's Vineyard. And also Mashpee was incorporated in the same year by the Commonwealth and the legislation up at the State House. So ever since then, it's been, paying taxes. In the 70s, the tribe tried to sue for the land. We weren't, victorious because we weren't, quote-unquote, a federally recognized tribe or an acknowledged Indian tribe. We didn't gain our federal recognition until 2007. And this is still a battle that we're still, fighting. I mean, luckily we have a new administration, but the former administration occupying the White House, is trying to take what little lands we do have, out of trust here in Mashpee. So as you can see, this battle's been going on for well over 400 years. You know, we're asking for a small fraction in amount of our ancestral homelands that we once had. The original deed from the King of England is, you know, a 55-square-mile deed that was given to the Mashpee Indians, the South Sea Indians, forever and never to be sold. And there's laws that say that you can't sell Indian land without Congress's consent. And, you know, that's just kind of some of the challenges that we face, you know, particularly here in Mashpee, as well as a lot of other trust responsibilities that have been broken with other various nations throughout Indian country. So I think that each tribe is different, and I think that it, you know, depends on, you know, who you ask. But that's kind of a brief overview of, you know, just Mashpee's history, you know, from contact, you know, kind of spanning over the last 400 years with our own personal issues with the government or the Commonwealth.
Yeah. So, Brian, when Nelson suggested enlisting the support of FEMA, was this met with any kind of concern or opposition from the from those in the tribe?
Not really. The tribe actually has laws and legislation that, you know, in the event of a state of emergency, you know, even the elected tribal council members of the tribe aren't really allowed to override or make, you know, decisions without, you know, Nelson's approval as the emergency management director. So he kind of, you know, has that capability, and the tribe really just, you know, relies on him for that and, you know, to support him in that role, in the position. He does run a lot of things by tribal council, you know, or myself, you know, just working together with him on this because I'm the point of contact from the tribe in regards to this with Indian Health Services and the vaccinations and so on and so forth. So I don't think there's really been any resistance so much. I think that it's great because with Nelson's work from FEMA and the help that we've gotten from, you know, the federal government, Indian Health Services with the vaccination and the testing and stuff, the community, I believe, is, you know, very pleased. I haven't really heard otherwise.
Yeah. Jennifer, give us a sense of how the federal government is viewed by members of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe.
Yeah, I mean, I should emphasize I can really only speak for myself as an individual citizen. I'm not an elected official, you know, representing anyone else. But I really just love the way that Brian brought the past, you know, four centuries ago into the present. And so much of what unfolded in Massachusetts has impacted all of Indian country. And it's really important for us to understand the policy framework that overarches the body of what's called Indian law in the United States, and it impacts every tribe. So if there's a Supreme Court decision that impacts one tribe, it will be applied to every tribe. And that's the legal status that we, you know, live under as tribal governments with this direct relationship to the federal government. But if we look back to the 1950s, you know, that's considered the termination era in tribal policy history. That was fortunately followed by the self-determination era in the 1970s, where tribal governments were able to reassert control and establish our own judicial systems, our own police forces, our own tribal housing agencies. And we were able to take back that control from federal agencies and implement those programs locally ourselves. And that's just a tiny snapshot. I mean, at Standing Rock, we have probably 60 to 70 tribal programs, and that workforce that I mentioned of over 400 people spanning two states and two separate counties. But just to think about, you know, how far we've come since the self-determination era, at the end of the 1970s, in 1978, a really critical piece of legislation was passed that people in my community fought for, people all over Indian country fought for, and it was the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. And so those of us who are fortunate to be born in the 70s and in the 80s, we have grown up in an unprecedented era with the right to practice our tribal religions openly. And I mean, just think about that, like what that means in a country that prides itself on religious freedom and all the ways that we see Christianity as an underlying force for, you know, all kinds of social policy making today. But we had to wait until 1978, until our elders could openly hold our ceremonies again. And in the 1990s, when I first started going to Indigenous language conferences and learning about Indigenous language movements globally and among Native American tribes, there were still elders who would stand up even into like 2008. I remember being at a federal language symposium and a Dakota elder standing up and saying that he still felt fearful of speaking his language in 2008, you know, almost 20 years after the passage of the Native American Languages Act in the early 1990s. And, you know, the distrust of the federal government is well-founded. You know, there was a tremendously powerful social movement among young people in Indian communities in the 1960s and the 1970s that culminated with the Trail of Broken Treaties, you know, the rise of the American Indian Movement, which was really in response to widespread police brutality against tribal communities in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And, you know, they were responding to, you know, conditions that were impacting tribal communities in urban areas. And why were all of those people in the urban areas? Because of the termination era and the relocation policies of the federal government to not just encourage, but to incentivize Native citizens to leave our land bases and to go to reservations. Because the idea was always that we were not going to survive. We were not going to continue to have these tribal nations, to have tribal governments, and to carry forward this direct federal to tribal relationship. But we're still here. We're still thriving. We're opening schools. We're running schools. You know, we have these incredibly complex tribal nations that often exist as a government of elected officials. And then in parallel are the traditional leaders in our communities. You know, in my community, that takes the form of treaty councils. But, you know, that's different in every community, whatever their traditional governing structures look like. But the impacts of, you know, federal mismanagement and federal graft and corruption, it's very real. And, you know, I'm thinking about young people in my community who yesterday ran 93 miles and 32 below wind chill because today there was supposed to be a hearing with the Army Corps of Engineers trying to explain why they are still operating a pipeline under our primary water source. And, you know, the Army Corps took land on Standing Rock in 1944. They flooded 46,000 acres of our best farmland, our orchards, our gardens. They destroyed our food systems. And the point of that was for flood control downstream, for commerce downstream. You know, it was supposed to generate electricity for, you know, all of our communities. But it was no coincidence that most of the dams that were built through the Pick-Sloan Act in the 1940s were just adjacent to Indian reservations. And Standing Rock did not suffer the worst of those losses. Our sister tribes did at Cheyenne River, at three affiliated tribes, Mandan, Hidatsa, Arikara Nation, up in the Dakotas. I mean, and this pattern of dams and the destruction of tribal waterways and food systems, that is something that has happened everywhere. And that's why when our young people in 2016 ran to the Army Corps in Nebraska, you know, the regional headquarters, and then they ran to D.C. to make the point that this was an illegal act that was happening. And we have since in court, our tribal attorneys and Earth Justice and many thousands of incredible lawyers and allies from everyone from the ACLU to the Lakota Law Project to the Water Protector Legal Council, you know, they have really claimed major victories in the courts, and yet this pipeline is still operating. And, you know, there are generations of us who have been raised to understand that we do not trust or cede our inherent sovereign rights to the government ever. And that is not about, you know, not wanting to be collaborative. It's about demanding the respect that we deserve as the First Nations of this land.
866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the social, emotional, and economic toll of the pandemic on Indigenous people. With us is Jennifer Weston. She's a Lakota citizen of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and director of the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project. Nelson Andrews, Jr., Department Director of Emergency Management for the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe. And Brian Whedon, he's a Mashpee Wampanoag Tribal Councilman. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Brian, worldwide, the economic toll from the pandemic has been significant. How are revenue streams for the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe being impacted by the pandemic?
So the tribe is being financially impacted by this pandemic in, you know, various ways, you know, from tribal members, you know, being unemployed to our cultural resource monitors, our Tribal Historical Preservation Department. Really runs off of the revenue they receive from doing CRM work, the cultural resource monitor work, when they do cell towers and stuff like that. Because of the impact, we haven't really been able to get any of our cultural resource monitors out there to do this work, which is causing, you know, the cultural department to lose revenue. We weren't able to open our tribal museum that we have in Mashpee this year. We weren't able to have our powwow, and the powwow was kind of the big moneymaker, if you will, for the tribe. Back in the day, the powwow was the funds that the tribe would use to keep the tribal council afloat and, you know, paid the phone bills and, you know, all that good stuff back in the day, obviously before, you know, the tribe grew in their capacity that we're at today. But it's impacted us in many ways. Our fishermen, like Jen had said earlier, a lot of our tribal members still live off of the land. And outside of just some of our tribal members that go out there to get, you know, food and sustenance for their own families, they do also make a living off of it. We have a lot of commercial shell fishermen who can't really sell to the market right now. The tribe has our own oyster farm that we can't really sell any of our oysters that we've been, you know, growing and cultivating out here in our bays because of, you know, the lack of, you know, the purchases and everything else like that. So it's been a real financial impact on the tribe, and that's why the tribal council decided to use some of our CARES Act funds to give our tribal members direct payments to help them out, as well as implement various other programs to help them out with housing and so on and so forth.
Mm. Nelson, tell us about the vaccine rollout for the tribe. Have you had trouble receiving enough vaccine for tribal members, and do you have a timeline to have everyone vaccinated?
Sure. So we created a vaccination plan through the Emergency Management Department, and it was passed in the tribal council for review. Brian was, Councilman Whedon was appointed as a point of contact between IHS as well regarding vaccinations. I wrote the plan starting back when the CDC was deployed here. We started this back about 6 months ago, actually. So we are already into two of the phases with our vaccination rollout. So the way we wrote it was a three-phased approach. Starting off with healthcare workers. So the healthcare workers that work over at our Indian Health Service Clinic had the option to get this first. And then we wanted to go into essential employees and also members of our community who are at high risk for contracting the virus. Those with pre-existing conditions and also those over 65 years of age, members that are living within our county health service delivery area were first. The Indian Health Service Clinic also has a planning strategy that's through Nashville that they're revising and implementing according to their guidelines as well. The goal is to get all of our tribal community members vaccinated, the ones that would like to get the vaccination, and also the spouses and members that reside within their household. Where we are on track, the thing is, there aren't there aren't as many vaccines available, it seems, for tribes as there are, say, for our state counterparts. You know, say
you request 1,000 vaccinations like we did initially, you get 100. So that a lot of that has to do with the capacity, how the federal government that distributes it feels, you are going to be able to distribute these vaccines in a timely fashion. But we are working toward getting more vaccines out to the community and working closely with our Indian Health Service Clinic that's on our tribal lands here. I kind of wanted to not really switch gears, but touch on one other thing as well while we have the time.
Sure, go ahead.
Sure. So a lot of this stems from the support that we were able to provide to our tribal community, right? That stems from the amount of support we're able to get at times from, from the federal government. Obviously, we're sovereign. We want to be able to take care of our folks, on our own, and that is our ultimate goal. But states do receive direct funding from the federal government on a daily basis. One of the organizations that I work closely with is the United South and Eastern Tribes. I sit as the co-chairman for the Homeland Security Emergency Services Committee. So we've been collaborating with the National Congress of American Indians on some of these issues. Not to go too far off track, but there's an act in place. It's called the Stafford Act. The Stafford Act is pretty state-centric. And what this act does is it provides direct funding to states to handle things such as what we're talking about, right? Having the funds to have an emergency management department or staff that can support our tribal communities. The Department of Homeland Security has shown that it provides $17.6 million in federal assistance and $4.4 million in Homeland Security grants daily. Think about that. Each day, the states are getting about roughly $20 million, right? If you compare, this is where the disparity comes. If you compare that to tribal nations all combined, all 574 federally recognized tribes, we receive less than half of the state's daily allocation in the span of an entire year. So that's approximately $26.24 for each state resident annually, while only about $3.41 for each American Indian or Alaska Native citizen. So these are the bigger picture items, right? This is the congressional level items that we're trying to change through our national organizations. Because without this direct funding that's coming, it's flowing. It's coming into the states daily. Tribes aren't seeing, hardly any. Tribes are seeing less than 2% of it. So without this funding in place, we're forced to write grants on a weekly basis at times, right? Each year, I have to write at least 5 grants and hope to get at least 2 of them. Otherwise, we don't even have the support to provide the shelters for isolation for the tribal members that may have contracted COVID. The funds to buy the PPE gear, things like that. So that's the bigger picture there.
I want to ask you a question about this bigger picture. So have there been signals then from the Biden administration that indicate a willingness to forge a new and better relationship with Native tribes?
From what I've seen, yes. The Biden administration, one of the first acts that he, the first steps he took was to get Deb Haaland and, as the Secretary of the Department of Interior. So that's a promising sign. And he does have a lot of Native cabinet folks. I had the opportunity to meet with a congressman out in D.C. recently as well, and his point of view was that Biden's administration was pushing forward toward tribal issues and Native agenda items. So I do see a lot of hope in that, but time will tell. I think it's in our best interest.
Yeah. Jennifer, what would you like to see the federal government do differently when it comes to working with tribal nations and upholding indigenous rights?
I do think the Biden administration has taken some fantastic first steps. One of his recent executive orders was basically to reactivate Executive Order 13175 that requires consultation and coordination with Indian tribal governments. And this was an initiative under the Obama administration that was widely celebrated as an opportunity for tribal nations leaders to meet directly with the White House. And that is something that has really never happened before And, you know, the Biden administration understands, you know, the gains that were made during Obama's time in office. And so I think that's really promising. And I'm hopeful that in terms of, you know, their partnerships and collaborations, that they will be better listeners and better partners.
Yeah. Brian, going back to the vaccines for a moment, is there any reticence among tribal citizens to be vaccinated? And then what public education programs are in place around the vaccine?
So the tribe, after talking to Indian Health Services in one of our initial vaccination meeting, you know, planning strategic meetings that we had talked about, you know, various ways. One of the things that they did encourage was tribal leadership to take videos and to share them with your community. So, you know, that can go, you know, very, you know, further in the community than, you know, a Dr. Fauci or anyone else that you might not know receiving the vaccination. So I did take the vaccination as one of the tribal leadership of the tribe and did take a video to share it with the community, as well as some of our Indian Health Services staff also took some videos to share with the community. They've also, you know, updated their Facebook page, you know, and like I said, the tribe with their constant, you know, daily COVID reports from Nelson, the emergency management team has been great because, you know, there's been some events that we have had and we've just seen, you know, various outbreaks here and there. And the tribe does have, you know, a lot of support in place, such as, you know, hotel rooms for tribal members to quarantine. Even if you've been exposed or if you've contracted the virus, you know, there are places that the tribe has and programs that we have to make sure that everyone can quarantine and take the safety measures that they need, as well as, you know, delivering PPE and stuff like that that Nelson and his team do in his department. And it's really been a collaborative effort from everyone. And there are some tribal members who are a little hesitant, I think, about taking this vaccination. But I think that they just want to, you know, see how it plays out and see, you know, other people get vaccinated before themselves. And then also, it's, you know, up to their discretion. They might have underlying health conditions or some concerns because there's not enough research for their various, you know, illnesses and stuff, you know, that show that this vaccination can be, you know, compatible for them.
Yeah.
So I think there's multiple risks out there, but I think overwhelmingly the community is, you know, definitely in support of it. Our tribe members are trying to get vaccinated, the ones that want to, and the ones that don't want to, I think that they're starting to come around.
Yeah. Less than a minute, Nelson. FEMA has pointed to the Mashpee tribe management as a pandemic success story. Are there avenues and opportunities amongst tribal nations to share success stories or best practices?
So the avenues for different tribal nations would be through their FEMA tribal liaisons. Each FEMA region has a tribal liaison in place. You know, so those liaisons are responsible to ensure that each tribe has the opportunity to become direct recipients, such as we have, but also through the National Congress of American Indians, United South and Eastern Tribes, we try to support all the tribes within our jurisdictions as well, with getting these resources and to share best practices and also plans that, you know, may help them,
right. Help everybody. Yeah. We'll post more links with information about the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe's response to the pandemic, as well as links to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe at our website, capeandislands.org. Jennifer Weston, Nelson Andrews Jr., and Brian Whedon, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.